Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for attending session 354, titled The Chosen Seed, Reexamining Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage, 40 Years After Official Declaration 2. Please silence your cell phones. As you listen today, we invite you to explore what it means to be Mormon. Who gets to carry that label? What does the history say? What does the theology say? At this conference, we encourage you to explore what it means to be Mormon. We ask you to reflect on your own Mormon interactions and to hold the good and the bad together to create a more full, complete personal narrative. In doing this, we allow others to do the same. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Please consider purchasing Sunstone merchandise to support Sunstone, including tradable lanyard pins with prominent figures in Mormonism. There are also a wide variety of popular Sunstone chapsticks, mugs, bags, and more. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so that other presentations can begin to prepare for the next session. A little about this session. This session explores the concept of race and lineage, especially that of African Americans, through the lens of LDS church manuals and patriarchal blessings. The analysis utilizes never-before-seen documents from the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency. Matt Harris is a professor of history at Colorado State University, Pueblo. Sterling Adams is an independent scholar and attorney. And Newell Bringhurst is going to be making commentary and is a professor emeritus of history at the College of the Sequoias. We will now turn the time over to the session.
Within the LDS Church, it's rare that a doctrine or policy is created with a single pronouncement or with a series of statements, even when made by a prophet or set out in Scripture, or by a single event or many events over several years. For these things to take hold, to have staying power, they need to be nourished by many complementary actions and teachings and repeatedly nurtured over time, often many decades. Think of the rise and fall of the practice of spiritual adoptions, the ebbs and flows of second anointings, of the power once held by the Relief Society. Think of speaking in tongues, of women given blessings, of the flirtation with animal sacrifice. When it comes to Mormon concepts of lineage and that very constructed thing called race, and of ancient tribal blessings and cursings of a jealous, angry God that favored an epically sinful tribe, when it comes to Mormons defining themselves to be literal descendants of that tribe, legal heirs to amazing blessings. All this, too, was a belief system that didn't happen in an instant or two decades or five. These two slides summarize main lineage teachings in Mormonism. I won't go through them. In a manner difficult today to fathom, for mid-20th century Mormons, one's literal blood lineage was extraordinarily, eternally important. We know quite a bit now about how and by whom these ideas were first articulated in our church and how they developed into formal teachings and practices. But given these concepts are a direct rejection of the post-tribal message of the New Testament, and because they required huge, imaginative leaps of conspiratorial history to even come close to reaching plausible ground, how were they maintained for so long? Because there were so many historical, logical, and theological flaws buttressing our lineage practices, here's two of many, my thesis is that they could only continue to flourish or even survive if they received consistent nurturing over time. Because the European saints were not, in fact, descendants of Israel or Ephraim, any more than the rest of the world was, or any more than they and we are descended from Pharaoh or Confucius or their servants, and because Africans were not, in fact, descended from a Cain or Ham figure, for these things to be believed, support had to be conjured up from somewhere, And it was. In the first half of the 20th century, there was one church organization responsible for spreading among us an old shipload of false royal genealogies, bloodline conspiracies, and an affinity for bad history. That was the Genealogical Society of Utah. Founded by the church in 1894, by 1910 it had gathered some institutional heft and started the quarterly Utah Genealogical and Historical Magazine, which ran from 1910 through 1940, and published doctrinal essays and instructional content on finding ancestors. One of the features that distinguished the society was the content it produced to justify claims of the saint's Israelite lineage, claims that can now be seen as untethered from conventional notions of history and reality. This is where Odin and Thor, yes, that Odin, the Allfather, and that Thor, the god of thunder, take a break from Asgard to perch on a branch of many Mormon family trees, including my own. Much of the history we taught ourselves was copied directly from the Protestant British Israelism movement. But first, what also made the society stand out was that it was a marvel of organizational and pedagogical efficiency. Consider some examples of how it spread its message. By the 1920s, every stake and ward was tasked with creating a genealogy committee. By the mid-30s, each committee was supposed to include all of a director and two counselors, a secretary, and subcommittees for each of endowment ceilings, baptisms, temple projects, senior classes, junior classes, home teaching, finances, socials, and magazine and membership subscriptions. The quarterly magazine provided reports, stake by stake, of committee results. Next, after sustained pressure from the society and following placement of the society's Susie Young Gates on the Relief Society board, the Relief Society got religion on lineage. From 1915 to 1922, once a month, the Relief Society held a genealogy lesson. They published genealogy content in the Relief Society magazine. They sponsored a three-day churchwide genealogy conference and genealogy sessions during general conference. They developed coursework with the Genealogy Society, including the 600-page 1918 book compiled by Susie Young Gates called Surname Book and Racial History that was used in both organizations' classes. Annual genealogy conventions were held at stake, regional, and churchwide levels, at least in Utah, Arizona, Idaho, California, and Canada. This 1922 photo is of over 100 people that attended a week-long tri-state convention in Canada. In 1930, there were 60 regional conventions. 1935, 79. The conventions often spanned multiple days. Lineage-themed plays and pageants were written and produced at local and churchwide levels. These photos are from the 1932 pageant, George Washington's Birthright, performed at the Tabernacle and Assembly Hall. Each ward was encouraged to perform this pageant on the fifth Sunday of May, 1933. Genealogy committees owned the Sunday program for the ward on fifth Sundays. In 1919, the society had two full-time employees. By 1944, it employed 100 and was all of a publishing house, a center for curriculum development, a large library, a research center, with employees that performed outreach, training, and research throughout the church. Great effort was spent reaching youth with the lineage programs. A representative article in 1932 reminded readers the church had assigned the society to teach all members of every age. It encouraged them to assist in the monthly genealogy lessons taught in the lesser priesthood classes and to start weekly classes and activities for young boys and girls, starting the age of 8. Throughout much of the 1930s and 40s, Monday night was formally designated by the church as the night for, no, not family home evening, for genealogy classes. The fourth Monday of each month was genealogy home teaching night. A genealogy class was tasked with visiting two by two each family in the ward to give lineage lessons or assist in research. This effort was taken seriously. The January 35 magazine contained 30 pages of lessons on the art of home teaching, and two 15 to 20 minute scripts for plays to practice home teaching. In one of those, a father and son marvel at the, quote, wonderful plan of the German government of requesting every German citizen to establish his pedigree chart to prove his Aryan racial descent. As a side note, this play relied on a lengthy article written by society staff the year before in the April magazine, titled Search for Ancestors in Light of the German Racial Movement. It had a tone of breathless excitement in finding kindred spirits in Germany, reporting of great events and men of vision leading to the new Nazi government's sponsorship of racial research and a just-announced requirement for citizens to produce a pedigree chart. The article quoted extensively from a recent speech by German Cabinet Minister for Racial History and approvingly shared a separate proclamation that, quote, it has become a necessity for every German citizen backed by scientifically trained and organized societies to compile his family record and history, and this has to be accomplished in a very brief period of time. Next, after organizational arm-twisting by the then-society president, Joseph Fielding Smith, and placement of society representation on the Sunday school board, the Sunday school assented to teaching genealogy lessons during its class times from 1 to 3 times a month. In the 1930s and 40s, lineage-specific curriculum was developed by the society for junior and senior genealogy classes for the various Sunday school class age groups, starting at age 8, for Relief Society, College Institute, and for the weekday activities of the Young Men, Young Women program, the M-Men and Gleaner program, and for youth and adult priesthood lessons. As an example, this lesson called A White and Blessed People was in a priesthood manual published in the 30s. We'll see later it was used in one of the society's lineage manuals. The society also produced lineage content for weekly Desert News articles, publications such as the Improvement Era and Relief Society magazine, general conference sermons, radio firesides, and genealogy dances and yearbooks. So, the society had the machinery to spread lineage teachings among us, and so it did. Through a decades-long steady stream of lessons and sermons, if you were a Mormon born after 1880, but especially if you were born between 1900 and 1935, you were taught many dozens of times in multiple venues that you were literally an Israelite and as such particularly chosen and favored by God. The society had the blessing and support of church leadership, but it was largely through the drive and energy of a young Joseph Fielding Smith that it flourished, and the society became in important ways his doctrinal mouthpiece. Smith started working at the society in 1901, became a secretary in 1907, then librarian and treasurer. He was its vice president from 25 to 34, president from 34 to 61. He was a longtime editor of the magazine. He was its most prolific and prominent author of content, including teachings of Israelite identity and entitlements to blessings and curses. Of many books and articles he wrote for the society, the most prominent was his 1931 lesson manual, The Way to Perfection. Its 360 pages contained 49 chapters designed as the course material for a year and a half's worth of gospel doctrine classes. 13 of the chapters preached that lineage was a central characteristic defining one's relationship to God and to one's prospects for enjoying God's fullest blessings. These were chapters such as Appointment of Lineage, Ephraim and His Blessings, and Ephraim in the Latter Days. The chapters The Seed of Cain and The Seed of Cain After the Flood argued that blacks could not hold the priesthood. In addition to the book, class members or wards were also asked to purchase a separate study guide which contained lesson outlines and discussion questions. On this slide, we see how the class outline for The Seed of Cain After the Flood involves students in analyzing lesson content. Section 5C summarizes chapter content with the assertion that, quote, great rulers and constructive leaders and thinkers not supplied by this race, end quote. Later, one of the assignments the students are given is to, quote, discuss the truth of the statement in the text that Cain became the father of an inferior race. Another assignment is to, quote, name any great leaders this race has produced. Based on the text, the student is not expected to find an answer. In the 20th century, until the 1958 publication of McConkie's Mormon Doctrine, The Way was the only book written by a general authority that attempted to offer a detailed justification of the church's exclusion of people with black African ancestry. Over the years, as the book was designated by the church as the text for new lesson cycles, it was printed at least 18 times in English. The list of print dates you see here allows us to ponder how many times and at what ages a member born in a specific year, say 1915 like Bruce McConkie or 1924 like President Nelson, would have studied these lessons. The book was translated into at least Danish, Dutch, French, German, Portuguese, and Japanese. Outside the U.S., it appears to have been printed the most in Germany. As a contemporary side note, it was also released by Desert Book in Kindle format on Amazon in 2017. It was removed on May 9, 2018. In 1936, the Society published another lesson manual by Smith, The Progress of Man. This 500-page book was first used in courses in 36 and 37, then again in 40, 44, 50, 52, 64. This book and its separate 76-page study guide weren't as lineage-focused as The Way, and its lineage teachings were much more muted and less numerous and crowing, but they were there. Beyond the sheer volume of the print editions of The Way and The Progress of Man, it's important to emphasize that these were not texts written by a church leader and published by Deseret for passive consumption. perhaps as gifts or bookshelf fillers. They were published in so many print editions because members needed them for upcoming lessons. They read and studied the books and answered questions and wrote essays about their content because that's what the lesson outline directed them to do. The Way stood out from most other society publications in both its anti-black teachings and its restrictive salvation theology. Smith had a relatively restrictive view of the principles of the atonement, repentance, and forgiveness. What Smith had in common with many other society authors was at least partial adoption, and for some, it was whole hog acceptance, of the wild alternative world history of Anglo or British Israelism. Prior to the society, there was one text within Mormonism that prominently taught Anglo and British Israelism. George Reynolds was an original director of the society in 1894. His Are We of Israel was published in 1878 and at least in 1883, 1895, 1916, 31, 48, and 52. It was used as a Sunday school text in at least 1916. Are We of Israel was based on the writings of popular British Israel writers that answered the question with a strong yes. Reynolds restated a long list of legends about travels of Israel's lost 10 tribes and examined possible similarities between European cultures and the ancient Israelites to make the argument that the saints were of Israelite descent. This quote from the book captures well the approach of Reynolds and many Israelism writers within Mormonism. Quote, "It would be almost impossible to enumerate the likeness that had been found between the habits, manners, customs, personal appearance of the Israelites and Anglo-Saxons. It may be observed, however, that some of their identifications are very remarkable, while others are puerile and would be advanced by none but zealots." One of Reynolds' 32 children married Joseph Fielding Smith, and Reynolds appeared to be directly affected by Smith's lineage thinking. Reynolds' specific claims of dark-skinned people having degenerated from light-skinned ancestors due to sin are closely repeated in multiple of Smith's writings. In the 19-teens and 20s, magazine issues occasionally carried teachings of literal Israelite lineage. In the 30s and 40s, the society accelerated the pace with the production of 1- and 2-year lesson manuals that contained significant lineage content. The following are the other main lineage lesson manuals, not all of them, published by the society. Our Lineage was published in 33 and 38. 10 of its 40 lessons were published as a group under the category The Story of Our Race, the next 10 under Our Honorable Parentage. The remaining 20 dealt with technical research skills and less lineage-focused doctrines. Of the 40 lessons in the 1937 Children of the Covenant, about 6 focused on the British Israel teachings such as ancient Irish pedigrees, who are the Anglo-Saxons, early Welsh customs, and Teutonic tribes. 6 teach Israelite origins for islanders or peoples in the Americas, including Maori traditions and genealogies, our Indian brethren, and a white and a blessed people, which we saw was included in Manual for Priests in the same decade. About 10 center on teaching the youth they are of a chosen lineage and their attendant blessings and responsibilities. The Fourth Father Quest was used in classes in 37 to 39. About half the lessons focus on lineage doctrines. The other half teach research techniques. In 1942, the society prevailed on the Sunday school to adopt the 1- to 2-year course Birthright Blessings. The first 17 lessons focused on teaching saints they were of a chosen lineage. The remaining 31 mostly presented the historical case that Israelites had settled the European lands from which the saints had migrated. Many were adaptations, sometimes very close adaptations, of British Israel publications. As an example, Lesson 25, The Mound Builders of Europe, presented proof from archaeology that Scandinavia, Russia, and Ukraine were settled by Israelites. The majority of the text consists of quotes from other historical works, including 3 British Israel books from the late 1800s. I'll read the title of just one, 50 Reasons Why the Anglo-Saxons Are Israelites of the Lost Tribes of the House of Israel. No, that was so fun, I'll read another. The Israelites found in the Anglo-Saxons, the 10 tribes supposed to have been lost, traced from the land of their captivity to their occupation of the Isles of the Sea, with an exhibition of those traits of character and national characteristics assigned to Israel in the books of the Hebrew prophets. Lesson 26, Sagas and Civilizations of Scandinavia, relied on 11th to 13th century Icelandic Eddas and Sagas that set down a mix of long-held oral traditions and new fictional stories that became the Scandinavian mythology. The Origin of the Franks section displayed the 3-step intellectual dance of how society authors, including Smith and The Way to Perfection, commonly used as evidence historical traditions that were widely considered by mainstream historians to be of suspect origin or fictional. First, the article acknowledged there are questions as to the source's veracity. Here, these pedigrees are so ancient it is impossible to test their accuracy from historical facts, but according to legends. Second, the article presents evidence from the suspect source. In this case, it's a legend of a 4th century BC son of a, quote, chief prince of Ephraim, whose people are expelled by the Goths from their home at the mouth of the Danube. A portion of them are rumored to migrate to Holland and the Netherlands. Third, the article draws a firm conclusion that no longer carries any hesitancy. Quote, this makes it evident that the Frankish or Germanic nations also have an Israelitish origin. There are many examples of this laundering of bad history in birthright blessings, multiple in this chapter. I've run across dozens of examples in the writings of the society. There may be hundreds. The sections, the Ynglinga Saga and Norse and Anglo-Saxon genealogies, recount portions of the Snorri Sturlason 13th century tale of Odin and his son Skald. Snorri sagas are the chief source of popular Norse mythology and contain, well, they consist entirely of stories like you see in Marvel Comics superhero movies starring Odin, Loki, and Thor. But in the 13th century version, they are much less believable. The Birthright Blessings authors snatch from the tales just what is needed to deduce a line of lineage from the saints to the Norse kings to the Israelites. Lesson 26 ends with the conclusion that, quote, even if in after years Odin was deified by the Norse and worshipped as a god, the most authentic of these genealogies indicated that he was actually a real personage as shown by the sagas. This is at least the fourth time I've seen Odin appear in society publications. I think there's two more, but I couldn't find them in a recent review. The first two were in 1915, though the second of those hedged that Odin's historicity was not well established. Lesson 27, Who Are the Anglo-Saxons? Concludes, we should all be proud of our Anglo-Saxon descent because it proves that we too are children of the covenant. Beyond the genealogy lessons published by the society, society leaders also published lineage books with the church's Deseret Printing House and with independent publishers. A prominent example published by Deseret was Apostle and Society President Anthony Ivins' intentionally fictional 1931 eugenics novel, Her Mother's Daughter. Another was James Anderson's God's Covenant Race, published in 37, 38, 44, and 46. Anderson was a founder and original director of the Society. He was also its executive secretary for 40 years. From the book cover showing the covenant race as a crowd of light-skinned people to its strong teachings of racial purity, racial identity, and racial destiny, it is an extreme source of lineage teachings. It includes full copies of articles from the contemporary British Israel magazine, Destiny. It reprints 120 pages of Destiny articles, most by William Cameron, who in the 1930s was president of the American Anglo-Saxon Federation, and, oddly, one of America's most well-known anti-Semites. In the late 20s, he went to trial on a nationally publicized libel suit after the newspaper he edited, Henry Ford's The Dearborn Independent, published multiple alt-right anti-Semitic articles and popularized the 1920s hit forgery, The Protocols of the Elders of Zion. God's Covenant Race appeared to have been prepared as a lesson manual as it contained study questions at the back of chapters. I have found society lesson outlines that refer to the book. I haven't verified it was used as a manual. Apostle and Society Director John Widso positively reviewed the book in a 1938 Improvement Era article. Of Anderson's British Israel claims, Witzer wrote, the historical tracing of the lost tribes of Israel is very interesting and instructive, though he did chide the author for not teaching that all people could be adopted into Israel. He concluded with the short review with an endorsement. The astute observer may notice after close inspection some difference between the ethnicity of God's covenant race in 1938 versus 2018, as shown in the church's program handout for the recent B1 event. Conclusion. These lineage teachings were all based on bad history, bad science, bad theology. So why weren't they eliminated decades earlier? And why haven't they been fully excised now? Especially given that you could completely remove the doctrine of chosen lineage from Mormon theology, as many Mormons have, and lose nothing, and require no change except that patriarchal blessings would either have different content or be interpreted differently. What does this say about our epistemology as a community, our ways of learning? What does this suggest about our future ability to correct current beliefs or practices? The genealogical society was the principal source of the nourishing, the fertilizer that was laid down, particularly in the 30s and 40s, to reify Mormon lineage beliefs. For those mid-20th century Mormons, which includes people of President Nelson's age, for at least the decades of the 1930s and 40s, they were taught year after year in multiple types of lessons, in multiple venues, that scripture and the overwhelming mass of evidence from the fields of archaeology, anthropology, zoology, history, philology, semiotics, government, law, and religion confirmed that the saints were principally descendants of the Israelites, uniquely so compared to the rest of the world. I suggest that without the cavalcade of teachings of Mormon Israelism that we've seen from the society, the practice of restricting black members from temple blessings and full membership in the church in heaven, the principal apostasy of this dispensation, could not have been maintained. It would have disappeared decades earlier. In fact, if we allow for the guilty pleasure of counterfactual daydreaming, I believe if we could excise a single book of lineage teachings from the Mormon past, the society's lesson manual, The Way to Perfection, all other things being equal, the lineage restrictions wouldn't have lasted out of the 1950s and perhaps not beyond the 40s. Thank you.
I feel like we just heard a lesson in Nazi propaganda. So nicely done. I enjoy going to conferences as most of us do, and whenever my neurons are snapping, it's a well-served session. And so thanks, Sterling, for making my head explode for the last hour. Anyway, so I appreciated Sterling's presentation. It complements my work nicely. I'm going to explore lineage from a patriarchal blessing standpoint. And just a quick word about how this project got started. My paper today is called Mormons and Lineage, The Complicated History of Blacks and Patriarchal Blessings, 1830 to 2018. And just a few months ago, Boyd Peterson's in the back and waved to everybody and going to put a plug in for Dialogue, of which Boyd edits. So Boyd contacted me 4 or 5 months ago, and he just said, I heard you're working on blacks and race. Do you have anything to contribute to the 40-year anniversary edition that'll be out in the fall of 18? And I said, well, let me look at my files. And as I've been working on a book about blacks and Mormons since World War II, I noticed that, as any good historian has, a burgeoning file that maybe 20% or 10% will make it into the actual book. So I found a big, thick file that said Blacks and Patriarchal Blessings, and this is the genesis of this presentation today, and also a 48-page article that will be published next month with Dialogue. So if you're curious to learn more about this story today, I would certainly have you go to that article. But in the interest of time, I decided today to give you just a quick, brief overview of the 19th century of how race and patriarchal blessings play out. And I want to focus more on something that often gets omitted from writing Mormon history, and that's contemporary Mormon history. And there's a lot of reasons for it that we won't have time to get into today. But I thought that you might be more interested in this story from World War II forward and some of the challenges it is of declaring lineage on a race of people that are outside of the House of Israel. And that's what we mean when we say that when Latter-day Saint leaders have taught that black people are from the curse of or the seed of Cain or Ham. So with that said today, I argue that Mormon leaders did not have a coherent policy of declaring lineage on persons of African descent. Some patriarchs pronounced the seed of Cain on black Mormons during their blessings, others the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, while still others no lineage at all. Not until the late 20th century did Mormon leaders begin to address the inconsistent, haphazard manner in which patriarchs declared lineage on black Latter-day Saints. After the priesthood restriction was lifted in 1978, church leaders unequivocally affirmed that blacks could now be adopted into the House of Israel. Yet, as I'll argue today, the new lineage theology did not resolve the longstanding Mormon tension whether or not blacks were cursed. In 2018, some 40 years after the priesthood and temple ban ended, black lineage remains a vexing problem today. The earliest known black man to receive a patriarchal blessing was Elijah Abel, a faithful Latter-day Saint who joined the church in 1832. Abel was one of a handful of blacks to receive the priesthood prior to Joseph Smith's death in 1844. Early church records indicate that Abel, Joseph T. Ball, and Walker Q. Lewis all held the priesthood, and possibly two other men of African descent, William McCary and a guy named Black Pete. Available records indicate that during the church presidencies of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, just five African Americans received their patriarchal blessings: Elijah Abel, Joseph Ball, Walker Lewis, Anthony Stebbins, a black slave of whom we know very little about, and Jane Manning James, of whom we know quite a bit about. In the 19th century, church patriarchs were inconsistent in assigning lineage to these black Latter-day Saints. Some declared no lineage, as in the case of Elijah Abel, some Cain or Canaan, as in the case of Lewis, James, and Stebbins, and some of the tribe of Joseph, the son of the powerful Hebrew patriarch Abraham. And this is Joseph Ball. Let me just pause parenthetically. I'm sure there are more black Latter-day Saints who had their blessings under Smith and Young. So the operative word here is available evidence. Well into the 20th century, the ambiguous status of black Latter-day Saints continued. This was complicated by the increased number of blacks baptized into the church. As black and biracial Latter-day Saints trekked west and settled in Utah, they sought their temple and patriarchal blessings. One of these converts, a man named Church, inherited Negro blood from his mother. The patriarch informed him in the blessing that he was of the lineage of Ephraim and that he should receive the priesthood and go on a mission. Cases like this prompted prolonged discussions within the Quorum of the Twelve. Apostles struggled with cases that came before them dealing with part Negroes like Church. Could he hold the priesthood? Could he serve a mission? Was it appropriate to declare him a lineage of Ephraim? These and other questions increased after the American Civil War. The lack of direction from church headquarters in declaring lineage created anguish for many patriarchs. Dozens of stories, both firsthand and anecdotal, illustrate the difficulty of pronouncing lineage on the church's relatively small but faithful black population. For example, Orson Sperry, a patriarch from Utah, gave patriarchal blessings to an engaged couple who were soon to be married in the Salt Lake Temple. Sperry gave the young man a very wonderful blessing, but when he blessed the woman, he put his hands on her head and struggled. He paused, then said, "I'm sorry, but there's no blessing for you." The young woman broke down. "I'm sorry, but there's no blessing for you. You have the blood of Cain flowing in your veins, and there's no blessing for you." The young woman broke down and wept. Sperry agonized over the incident, informing the couple that there would be no temple marriage because of her Negro lineage. A similar incident occurred in Rexburg, Idaho, when a handsome young man requested a patriarchal blessing. A brother Knutson in the church patriarch's office witnessed what happened. The church patriarch, when he laid his hands upon his head, refused to give him a blessing. He told him that he had the blood of Cain flowing in his veins. James Wallace, a traveling patriarch in the Canadian and Northern States Mission, was similarly anguished about giving a blessing to a person of African descent and sought assistance from church leaders in Salt Lake City. In 1934, the Duckworth family had requested their patriarchal blessings, but they had been accused of having Negro blood. Wallace agonized over the request, receiving no guidance from his ecclesiastical superiors on how to assign lineage when he was called as a patriarch in 1932. Uncertain how to proceed, he contacted Apostle Charles Callis, who had extensive experience around colored members of the church, having presided over the Southern States Mission for nearly three decades. Callis sympathized with Wallace, but didn't offer assistance. Wallace then contacted Apostle John A. Widso, who asked LDS Church President Heber J. Grant for instruction. Grant responded through Widso that it would be all right to bless them, but as to their status in the future, that is a matter that is in the hands of the Lord. Why President Grant failed to provide a definitive answer on black lineage can only be a matter of speculation. He clearly believed that blacks had a cursed lineage. In private letters to Latter-day Saints and in private meetings with the Quorum of the Twelve and First Presidency, he made his views known. Nevertheless, the LDS leader and perhaps his apostles recognized that the pain that such declarations would cause blacks if patriarchs pronounced the lineage of Cain in their blessings. After all, one of the purposes of blessings was to provide comfort and guidance to one's life, and being associated with a cursed race, much less a figure linked with Satan, was less than reassuring. Grant's ambiguous response to the question of black lineage only heightened Wallace's anxiety. Wallace agonized over the problem of the Duckworth family, stating in his journal that, quote, "It had caused me considerable anxiety and stress of mind, realizing as I sincerely do that with me rests the responsibility of declaring their lineage, close quote. With little guidance from church headquarters, Wallace attempted to trace the family's genealogy to determine bloodlines. He also fasted and prayed, hoping that God would reveal it to him. When that failed, he resolved to give them a blessing anyway, recording in his journal, "I am sure there is no objection to giving them a blessing of encouragement and comfort, leaving out all references to lineage and sealing." As cases like the Duckworth family circulated throughout the church, the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and First Presidency began to discuss lineage more earnestly. And this is about the time of Sterling's presentation today in the 20s and 30s. Indeed, by the early 20th century, LDS lesson manuals and church publications reinforced a whiteness theology extolling Anglo-Saxons as the chosen seed of Israel. So too did Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith, whose 1931 best-selling book, The Way to Perfection, outlined in vivid detail a racial hierarchy consisting of favored and less favored lineages. The outspoken Mormon apostle asserted that some lineages were blessed because of their valiance in a pre-earth life, while others bore the mark of a divine curse for some act or acts performed before they were born. According to Smith, blacks were not pre-assigned to a nation or tribe through the lineage of Abraham. Rather, their lineage, that of Cain and Ham, placed them outside of God's covenant blessings. Smith's teachings, couched in theological racism, echoed throughout the Mormon church, posing particular challenges for patriarchs when they gave blessings to American Negroes, black Africans, Australian Aborigines, black Fijians, and Philippine Negritos. Indeed, by the mid-20th century, patriarchs received no guidance at all on how to address these less favored lineages. In 1942, Apostle John A. Widsoe affirmed in an official church magazine, The Improvement Era, that patriarchal blessings may declare lineage, but he hinted that exceptions could be made for black people. The following year, the First Presidency made a similar statement, declaring that patriarchal blessings contemplate inspired declaration of lineage of the recipient. But the two statements were ambiguous with respect to black lineage. Phrases like may declare lineage and contemplate inspired declaration of lineage left open the possibility that patriarchs could omit lineage altogether if they were not sufficiently inspired. Allowing patriarchs to omit lineage resulted in church leaders' anxieties about determining who had Negro bloodlines and who did not. Such anxieties were rooted in the difficulties that Americans in general had in defining African ancestry following the American Civil War and continuing into the early 20th century. Some states stipulated that 1/16th African ancestry qualified for Negro status, while other states placed it at 1/8th or 1/25th. Mormons, by contrast, followed the one-drop rule based on lineage, not skin color. Various church presidents, in fact, claimed that any mixed bloodline between whites and blacks would classify them a Negro and therefore restrict them from the priesthood and temple rituals. To that end, Mormon leaders went to great lengths during the early to mid-20th century to determine bloodlines. J. Reuben Clark, a counselor to three church presidents, asked Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith, the church historian at the time and a leading doctrinal authority, to research if dark-skinned peoples in the Pacific Islands were of the seed of Cain. After extensive research, Smith claimed he didn't know. He looked at the Encyclopedia Britannica for that research, so. In some cases, Clark tried to determine black ancestry through scientific means, collaborating with Albin Mattson, an LDS doctor, to learn more about Negro blood. In other instances, LDS leaders instructed missionaries and members to conduct genealogical studies and lineage lessons to determine ancestry, particularly in South Africa and Brazil, two countries with a long history of race mixing. In lineage lessons, missionaries were instructed to discern ancestry by discreetly evaluating the person's nose, face, lips, and other features that might reveal whether or not the person had Negroid blood. They would go to the door and they would knock on someone's door as they're proselytizing. And if the person appeared to have Negroid blood, but they weren't sure, then they would come in and they would just talk and they would say, do you mind if I'm curious about your family? Do you mind if you show us your photo albums? And then they would show them the photo album and they're looking to determine if they have Negroid ancestry. And they might even be so brazen to ask them if they've been to Africa. The mission president also instructed these missionaries to ask suspected persons for permission to review the photo albums and also to ask them, in some cases, just directly, do you have ancestors in Africa? Other leaders looked to patriarchs to solve the problem. In Brazil, where lineage was difficult to determine, patriarchs became the final authority in determining priesthood eligibility. General authorities, no pressure, patriarchs. General authorities instructed patriarchs that if they detected the lineage of Cain, they were to refrain from declaring lineage. If, on the other hand, they felt prompted to declare one of the tribes of Israel, then the recipient was cleared for the priesthood and, as was often the case, missionary service. As one scholar wrote, quote, "It was a very simple method to dispose of the difficult administrative problem of determining lineage in questionable cases," end quote. As one might suspect, patriarchs felt tremendous pressure to determine lineage. Oftentimes, their declarations of lineage led to disappointment and confusion, as in 1962 when a patriarch told a newly baptized convert, who looked Hawaiian, that he had mixed lineage, which stemmed from dark-skinned people in his family line. The patriarch explained in the blessing that there is insufficient record or guidance for me to declare the certainty of your lineage. The man, along with his wife, who heard the blessing, was stunned, both because the missionaries told them that the patriarch could resolve the man's priesthood eligibility and because it left his lineage in limbo. In protest, the wife wrote a blunt, angry letter to President McKay. "I think this church is bigoted, biased, and prejudiced," she lashed out. My husband joined the church to try and clear up this mess, adding, "I don't know what you can do, but please try to help us. We are a happier family because of the church, and if it wasn't for this mess, we would be deliriously happy." I'm not sure what that means, deliriously happy. In some cases, local leaders resisted when patriarchs declared the lineage of Ephraim on dark-skinned Latter-day Saints. In 1961, Donald Hemingway, a stake president in England, interviewed a young man who had kinky hair and dark skin and possibly even Negro blood. Yet the patriarch proclaimed in his blessing that he descended from the lineage of Ephraim, effectively clearing him for priesthood ordination. Hemingway, troubled by the young man's outward appearance, refused to ordain him, at which point LDS Church President David O. McKay intervened and allowed the ordination to move forward. Addressing these cases on an ad hoc basis became even more difficult in the decades following World War II. During the post-war years, as the Mormon Church expanded throughout the Pacific Islands, Europe, and South Africa, or South America, determining lineage became increasingly problematic as biracial, light-skinned, and dark-skinned Latter-day Saints joined the church in these racially mixed countries. Without proper guidance on how to handle these cases, patriarchs did not follow a consistent policy declaring lineage on persons with suspected African ancestry or persons whose African ancestry was unchallenged. Some patriarchs declared the lineage of Cain, some Ephraim, some Manasseh, some no lineage, while others refused to grant blessings at all if they suspected them of having Negro blood. Concerned about the problem, Apostle Joseph Fielding Smith called for a church-wide meeting of patriarchs on October 11, 1958. They met at Barrett Hall on the campus of the LDS Business College in Salt Lake City. Apostle Smith cut right to the heart of the problem. "There was a problem which to me is serious," he cautioned the patriarchs. "A patriarch gave a blessing to an individual who had Negro blood in his veins and said, 'You are of the house of Israel and entitled to all the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.' A Negro cannot hold the priesthood, and not holding the priesthood, they cannot, until the Lord removes the restriction, enter into the exaltation of the kingdom of God, because that would entitle them to all the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." "That is a very serious matter," Smith concluded, "and we should be extremely careful to know the Lord is speaking to us, because Negroes cannot receive the fullness." Smith reiterated his hardline position during the question and answer period when a patriarch asked about lineage. "We have a young man who joined the church, and there was a question as to his lineage. Is there any reason why they couldn't call upon the patriarch to see if he could give it to them, to see whether or not they have colored blood?" a well-intentioned patriarch asked. "He has a right to inspiration," Joseph Fielding Smith said. But Smith did not address the specific lineage in his answer, only that patriarchs have a right to declare lineage. Later, Smith clarified black lineage in an Improvement Era article that was republished in a volume called Answers to Gospel Questions. The apostle removed any ambiguity about black lineage when he emphatically stated, quote, "that a Negro may have a patriarchal blessing, but it would declare him to be the lineage of Cain or Canaan." Smith's unambiguous position on the church's small but noteworthy black population was echoed by his son-in-law, Bruce R. McConkie, who shared his father-in-law's penchant for doctrinal certainty. In his best-selling book, Mormon Doctrine, published in 1958, McConkie, then a member of the First Quorum of the 70, expressed strong anti-black views. "The Negroes are not equal with other races where the receipt of certain spiritual blessings are concerned," he pronounced, "particularly the priesthood and temple blessings that flow therefrom." McConkie went on to state that this inequality is not of man's origin, it is the Lord's doing, based on his eternal laws of justice. McConkie further elaborated his views in a series of lectures given in 1967 to Mormon students at the University of Utah. You automatically got the priesthood if you belonged to the right lineage, he candidly explained. Negroes are Negroes because of the preexistence. They were less valiant. They did not develop the talent for spirituality that some others did. The House of Israel is the House of Israel because of our preexistence. McConkie's forceful views reflected the essence of Mormon lineage theology, underscoring a stark racism that consigned black Latter-day Saints to the margins. Without fully understanding how his teachings affected people of color, the Mormon leader made it emphatically clear where blacks stood in God's racial order. A student asked McConkie if a Negro can have a patriarchal blessing and the blessing tell him he's adopted in the House of Israel, and McConkie replied, no, Negroes can't go to the temple and they can't have these blessings. Eldridge G. Smith, LDS Church patriarch from 1947 to 1979, shared Joseph Fielding Smith's and Bruce R. McConkie's doctrinal views affirming black inferiority. In a general conference sermon in 1952, Smith proclaimed that blacks were not direct descendants from the House of Israel and therefore not entitled to the priesthood or declaration of lineage. Declarations of lineage or assignments, he explained, were only reserved for persons of a certain ancestry, whether born into the covenant or adopted into it through baptism into the church. Thus, he reasoned, blacks could not be adopted to the House of Israel and assigned a specific lineage because they were a cursed race. Smith refined and indeed expanded his views on race in 1966 devotional address at BYU. In that controversial address, the outspoken Mormon patriarch reaffirmed his belief that leadership blessings are not for the Negro, but then he added a twist. His is to be a servant. So as a servant, he cannot be a leader. This is in front of 20,000 people at the Marriott Center. Smith further opined that since blacks were not eligible for the blessings of Israel, they could not receive a true patriarchal blessing. Theirs would not be much different than the blessing that any bishop or home teacher or anyone else holding the priesthood would give, he noted, except that they would have the right to have it recorded, and these blessings are recorded. Smith also stated that patriarchs were to omit lineage during the blessings to black people. Patriarch Smith's assertion that blacks would be servants to whites eerily echoed the pro-slavery views that Brigham Young expressed in 1852 when he first announced the practice of restricting blacks from the priesthood. Smith's frank opinions shocked even BYU President Ernest Wilkinson, who was known for his hardline views on race. In response to Smith's address, Wilkinson shared his concerns with Apostle Harold B. Lee and Church President David O. McKay. In the midst of the turbulent civil rights era, Wilkinson worried about a public backlash against Mormon racial teachings. George Romney, a contender for national political office, especially concerned the brethren. They feared that LDS racial teachings would bring undue attention to his political candidacy. With that context, David O. McKay directed that no part of Smith's address be printed. So if you look at BYU in the printed address, you won't see it. Apostle Mark E. Peterson experienced similar criticism 12 years earlier when he gave a controversial address to LDS religion instructors at BYU. In it, he said, quote, that if a Negro is faithful all his days, he can and will enter the celestial kingdom, but will go there as a servant, close quote. Concerned Latter-day Saints condemned Peterson's sermon as a gross misreading of LDS scripture. One critic even labeled it as reminiscent of the Klan. Thus, Patriarch Smith's statements that on black lineage echoed Peterson's and only heightened an already tense problem within the church. We have these conditions by the thousands in the United States, Patriarch Smith candidly admitted, and we're getting more of them. To that end, the apostles convened a special meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve in March of 1970 to resolve the issue. The meeting focused exclusively on the Negro and patriarchal blessings. Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley described some of the blessings given by Patriarch John Smith in May of 1895 when he stated that the individual receiving the blessings was of the lineage of Ham. Hinckley also referred to a number of other blessings which had been given by various patriarchs in the church in which the lineage of Ham was stipulated in their blessings. The meeting minutes record that it was discussed and it was the feeling of the brethren that it is difficult to prescribe some of these lineages and some of these blessings, that this is a matter which should be left to the patriarch under the inspiration of the Holy Ghost. Apostle Ezra Taft Benson reminded his colleagues that one of the great purposes of a patriarchal blessing is to give the lineage, and on many occasions when lineage is not indicated, it becomes a real concern for the recipient of the blessing. The meeting revealed that members of the 12 could not agree on a lineage policy. Thus, the apostles placed the burden of determining lineage back on the patriarchs themselves. The meetings also revealed that certain members of the 12 clashed with Patriarch Smith over his responsibilities in the office of the patriarch. Indeed, the differences between the apostles and Eldred Smith revealed deep fissures within church leadership. In 1971, Patriarch Smith met with the apostles to resolve their differences. Apostle Spencer W. Kimball characterized the patriarch as, quote, argumentative during their meeting. The tension between the members of the 12 and Smith was palpable and perhaps irresolvable. Whereas Smith instructed that blacks should not receive lineage in their blessings, some apostles insisted that they should. And whereas Patriarch Smith viewed blessings for black Latter-day Saints as father's blessings, certain apostles contested that characterization. The apostles' inability to reach a consensus on black lineage with Patriarch Smith and within the Quorum of the 12 posed further problems for patriarchs. At a patriarchs meeting on April 6, 1973, some 114 patriarchs met in Salt Lake City with apostles Delbert L. Stapley, LeGrand Richards, along with Eldred Smith. The questions immediately turned to lineage. In the immediate future, I'm going to have the opportunity of giving a blessing to a young Negro, a patriarch asked. I'm very apprehensive about the declaration of lineage. Apostle Stapley, seemingly unconcerned about Benson's assertion that lineage should be stated, opined that he wouldn't declare the lineage in a case of that kind. He instructed the patriarch to just tell them that they would obtain their blessings through the descendants of Abraham. He admitted his counsel was questionable, but he felt he had no other choice. Patriarch Smith responded, reiterating his previously stated views on race from his controversial BYU talk. I have given a number of blessings to Negro members of the church, but if you give them the declaration of the blessings of Israel, you are giving them the right to the priesthood, because the blessings of Israel are leadership blessings, which is the priesthood. So you give them a father's blessing, or a blessing by a patriarch, he concluded. You record it the same as a patriarchal blessing, but you cannot give them any of the blessings of Israel. Smith reaffirmed that there should be no declaration of lineage. Smith's dogged assertion that black Latter-day Saints were only eligible for father's blessings put him at direct odds with other church leaders. Complicating matters further, a patriarch asked, if lineage is not declared, could the patriarch add an addendum to the blessing, to which Apostle Stapley replied that he could, clearly revealing his differences with Patriarch Smith. But the most pointed question focused on the precise lineage that patriarchs felt inspired to declare. If the Spirit is to indicate a lineage of Cain, is it not possible to stipulate that, a patriarch asked. Apostle Richards, who was known in church circles for his volubility, had remained quiet up to this point. Richards responded, I don't think we ever ought to say anything that will discourage people. I wouldn't tell them that they are a descendant of Cain. You can get around it easier than that, and then you won't make them feel so bad. The problem of declaring lineage for black Latter-day Saints only persisted after President Kimball lifted the priesthood and temple ban in 1978. Most importantly, the priesthood revelation did not resolve the controversial question of whether or not blacks were a cursed race. A new edition of information and suggestions for patriarchs the church published in 1981 avoided the subject altogether. Nor did the apostles mend their differences with Patriarch Smith. The priesthood revelation only widened the gulf between them, culminating in President Kimball's decision to place Smith on emeritus status and permanently abolish the office of the patriarch in 1979. While the patriarch's son, Gary Smith, writes, quote, that it's not known what dynamics might have combined to cause Spencer Kimball to retire the office of the church patriarch, end quote, a major cause appears to be the patriarch's obstinacy over the lineage issue, which put him at loggerheads with other general authorities. Smith stubbornly insisted that blacks should not receive an assignment of lineage, despite the fact that they could now attend the temple and hold the priesthood. He also asserted that blacks could not be adopted into the house of Israel, which contrasted sharply with the apostles' teachings. For the apostles, however, the priesthood revelation changed the status of blacks within the house of Israel, even as church member leaders remained steadfast in their belief that God had cursed them. The revelation prompted the church hierarchy to rethink the lineage of black Mormons, particularly their status as God's covenant people. After 1978, apostles proclaimed that blacks could now be adopted into the house of Israel. They could experience all the rights and privileges that descendants of Ephraim and Manasseh enjoyed, including leadership in the church. Theologically, this meant that whatever lineage blacks had before 1978 no longer mattered. As bearers of the priesthood and participants in the sacred ordinances of the temple, they were now equal with God's favored lineages. In a private memo to President Kimball in 1978, the spring of 1978, Apostle Bruce R. McConkie provided a theological rationale for the change. Negro blood, McConkie reasoned, would be purged out of a human soul by baptism and the receipt of the Holy Ghost and by personal righteousness. Blacks could now be adopted in the house of Israel as the seed of Abraham, thereby qualifying for the blessings of exaltation. Apostle James E. Faust also addressed the point, asserting that it really makes no difference if the blessings of the house of Israel come through the lineage or through the spirit of adoption. All could be counted as the blood of Israel, whether figuratively or literally. A church manual further explained, converts to the church are Israelites, either by blood or by adoption. Nagging questions about lineage persisted, however. Some patriarchs expressed trepidation about having to discern a declaration of lineage for a black person. Other Latter-day Saints, insensitive to Mormon racial teachings, asked blacks about their lineage. So what's your lineage, a white Latter-day Saint queried Keith Hamilton, a newly baptized black convert. The seed of Cain, he sarcastically replied. The brother looked at his embarrassed wife and triumphantly proclaimed, "See, I told you." I guess the wife had more discretion than this brother did. Let me just conclude now with this presentation. In other instances, the priesthood revelation opened up new possibilities for black Latter-day Saints who were denied their lineage in their initial blessings. My black LDS family, including Darius Gray, Joseph Freeman, Sister Jerry Halwell, and many others, all went and got lineage after 1978, declared two black Latter-day Saints in 2017. But lineage remained confusing and inconsistent for many black Latter-day Saints, despite the church's quasi-official teaching that blacks could now be adopted into the house of Israel. A biracial man, for example, reported that in his patriarchal blessing in 1987, he was not designated a lineage. Confused, the young man sought another blessing in 1991 prior to his LDS mission, and the patriarch explained that he was of the lineage of Cain. This is 1991. This lineage designation disturbed the young missionary who lived believing that he was truly a descendant of Cain. He grew weary trying to prove himself worthy of the fullness of the Lord's blessings. These stories and more underscore the difficult experience that many black Latter-day Saints encounter when they receive their patriarchal blessings. Indeed, some black Mormons feel uncomfortable and ashamed when denied lineage or given vague promises through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Insensitive patriarchs are only part of the problem, though. The other is the church handbook, which neither addresses nor repudiates the Cain and Ham lineage designations. The handbook stipulates that patriarchs do not have to declare lineage from a particular tribe, but instructs patriarchs to assign blessings through Israel. But the problem goes deeper than just omitting lineage. In teaching that blacks derive from Cain and Ham, church leaders box themselves into a theological corner. They discourage patriarchs from declaring the blessings of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob on black Latter-day Saints because those were priesthood and temple blessings, but neither did they encourage patriarchs to declare lineage through Cain or Ham, notwithstanding Joseph Fielding Smith's assertion and answers to gospel questions. The priesthood revelation of 1978 eased some of the tension when the apostles affirmed that blacks could now be adopted into the house of Israel as full participants in Mormon liturgical rites. But this doctrinal shift did not resolve the vexing question of whether or not black people derive from the seed of Cain. The current church handbook states that some church members may not have any of the lineage of Israel. This is a startling admission given a recent church statement that disavows that black people are cursed. In the years to come, the church will undoubtedly align the antiquated church handbook with the new race and priesthood essay. This will be an important task, especially as the church continues to baptize and proclaim patriarchal blessings on people of color. Thank you.
I'm really pleased to be able to be a participant in this session to comment on these two excellent papers. This represents sort of an anniversary for me in that 30 years ago, I attended my first Salt Lake Sunstone symposium, at which I was asked to comment on a session dealing with the 10th anniversary of the lifting of the priesthood ban. And some 12 years before that, I participated in my very first MHA meeting with my good friend out there, Bill Russell. We were on a session at St. George, Utah, in which I gave my very first presentation on the black issue. So this is something that has kind of occupied my focus for my entire adult life. And so I have very strong feelings and emotions about this topic. And as I was explaining to a couple of women who are involved with the ordained movement when I was coming back from lunch today, I feel almost as strongly today about the issue of women and the priesthood as I felt about the black issue back before 1978. So this is indeed, a very important that we are observing the 40th anniversary or observance. I don't know. Sometimes I think we get a little bit too festive, you know, when they talked about the B1 thing as being a celebration. I had a bit of a problem with that terminology. What are we celebrating? But anyway, we could go on to the nuances of language and everything else. But these two papers today, I by these two younger scholars, seem like all the scholars now are younger than me, you know, as we've all, as time marches on. And I'm pleased to see these are two groundbreaking presentations. And I'm pleased that Matt's essay is going to be published in Dialogue. I really think it's a groundbreaking, path-breaking essay that in its fullest form, you'll be able to read it in its full, complete form. Matt just gave an excerpt, a portion of this. Even in this excerpt, it's prodigiously footnoted. He's got some 82 footnotes, as I counted them, just in the presentation he gave today. So he's thoroughly documented, and this guy is an indefatigable detective in going to the sources. He knows right where to go, and I just marvel at his tenacity and his ability to ferret out sources that people haven't been aware of. I mean, and that's reflected in this essay itself. The reason I say it is groundbreaking, when I wrote my Saints, Slaves, and Blacks back in 1981, I only gave cursory attention to the whole issue of patriarchal blessings and the impact and the interrelationship with the perpetuation of black priesthood denial. And I touched on it, but boy, Matt has really gone to the mat. A bad metaphor, bad pun here. Sorry about that. But he has done such a tremendous job of dealing with the sources. I guess one of the gee whiz moments for me was his discussion of Eldred Smith, the whole situation with Eldred Smith as the church patriarch. Because I remember when that office was abolished in 1979, I just assumed it was maybe because the church was becoming larger and larger, and the idea of a patriarch for the whole church was kind of something that was an artifact of an earlier, smaller church. I just didn't realize that the blatant racism and the attitudes that this guy had, you know, kind of an echo chamber for the writings and rantings of Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie, you know, and so to me that was one of the major gee whiz moments, as well as the church's unwillingness, or we talk about the LDS Church as being a tightly run organization, directed from the top down. The church leaders would say, gosh, we're having trouble coming up with some kind of a coherent policy to deal with this issue of lineage and how to apply it for faithful black Latter-day Saints. And they throw it back onto the shoulders of local patriarchs, which put them in agonizing positions. That's, you know, you've so as Matt has so articulately described in his presentation, and so I eagerly await the publication of Matt's excellent seminal essay in Dialogue. And if you haven't subscribed to Dialogue, I'm sure Boyd back there will see that you do that. There he is, right in the back of the room there. Now, turning to Sterling Adams' paper, again, another outstanding, fascinating presentation. And again, when I did my own study on blacks, on saints, slaves, and blacks, I didn't even mention the genealogical society. Shame on me, I guess. I don't know. Or because my research was, you know, focused largely on the 19th century. I can use that as a lame excuse, perhaps. But if I were going to go back and completely redo saints, slaves, and blacks, certainly the machinations, I guess I put it that way, of the genealogical society would be a crucial part of my presentation. And again, there were all kinds of gee whiz moments. For example, I mean, the thing that a major gee whiz moment was I guess I was unaware, or I just sort of passed it off as inconsequential, that the way to perfection was actually a collection of lesson plans, you know, published under the auspices and then promoted by the Genealogical Society. I guess I missed that, and I think that was a major insight, along with the other important publications, lesson plans, and everything else. And I really urge Sterling to, flesh out his essay a little bit more, and I really, really would love to see that ultimately in print. I think it's an absolutely outstanding piece of scholarship. I only have a couple of little questions that I sort of thought about. I departed somewhat from my prepared text. I've been doing this extemporaneously. I hope it doesn't sound too garbled or too disoriented, but I haven't even looked down my notes. But I did note a couple of questions that I do have. That you mentioned you focus on the Genealogical Society's activities during the 1930s and 1940s. That's the primary two decades that you focus on. And did the Genealogical Society, my question is this, continue to be a major source of Mormon lineage beliefs into the 1950s and 1960s? And if not, why did it discontinue this practice? Because this was at the very time when the black priesthood, the restriction was evolving from being a mere a practice into a doctrine. Because what happened in 49, when the church issued its official statement, it assumed almost a quasi-canonized status, that the church in its official 1949 statement did proclaim black priesthood denial to be clearly a doctrine, and that as a doctrine, that status of a doctrine was further reinforced in the 1969 statement, the infamous statement that Hugh B. Brown, almost at the point of a revolver, was compelled to sign along with his President Tanner. The two of them. And McKay himself, President McKay, was too sick. But by that time, it had been elevated to the status of doctrine. So it seems like these kind of teachings would have even been more in tune. But maybe part of it would be, I may be answering my own question, would be it was becoming increasingly an embarrassment as the church was coming under increasing attack. My second question is, why do you feel the church so vigorously promoted these racist ideas during the 30s and 40s, especially the 30s? Was this somehow, did they become infected with the racism that was prevalent in Nazi Germany? I mean, a significant percentage of the church's foreign involvement was in Germany. Germany was a major, we sort of forget that today because the church is pretty moribund in Germany today. But I would suspect, I've done a little bit of work on looking at the situation in Nazi Germany. When I did my earlier book on Fawn Brody, I got into that a little bit because her father was a mission president over in Austria, and I just wonder if they were kind of infected with the racism of that was prevalent in Germany and other countries. Kind of a situation that we see kind of rearing its ugly head today. I guess I better stop at that point.
A brief answer to those two questions is, I don't know. That's the accurate and honest answer, but I'm not wise enough to stop there. So to the first question, what happened in the 50s and 60s? Three things. One, in 1940, that was the last year the magazine was published. After that, it then had a section in the improvement era. And so the amount of content it was producing in the magazine diminished greatly. It continued to publish content in other sources. It continued to have lessons. For example, Way to Perfection is published four times in the 50s, I think. Progress of Man in the 50s being used as lesson manuals. So part of it is the organizational structure is changing. Part of it is World War II comes on, and we become almost instantly a little bit more international. I think that changes the focus. And then also, as you alluded to, in the 1940s, the world could see that this race stuff could be taken too far. And I think that toned things back. For example, God's Covenant Race was published several times under the title God's Covenant Race, and then it gets adapted and republished multiple other times under different titles, Joseph Smith and Destiny. I don't know, but I can guess that it was starting to feel in the 40s that, oh, God's Covenant Race, that doesn't sound good. That might be part of it. But it does look like there was less of this lineage content in the 50s and 60s, but it's a matter of scale. There was still quite a bit. To your second question, what was the cause? Again, the best answer is I don't know, but a couple of suggestions are in Brazil, in Germany, in Mexico, in Japan, you also see in this time period a influence or a heightened sense of ethnocentrism, of racial purity. You see the British Israelism movement, which has a resurgence in the 1870s, and then in Britain in the 1920s, it reaches its apogee in the U.S. in the 1930s. You could look at that and say, that matches up with economic depressions in these various places, and maybe it's tied to somehow this is a people's response to economic hardship. I don't have the skill set to think through that well, but these are all good questions.
That's a very convincing answer, yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You're going to moderate the question and answer? Yeah.
All right. So if you have a question, please make your way up to the microphone since it is being recorded.
You have a question, Doug?
First of all, I'd like to echo what Newell said, that I would love to see Sterling's essay in print. I'm glad to hear that Matt's will be, but they both are deserving of that. Secondly, I had my patriarchal blessing in the 1960s, and before I went, I was instructed by my bishop what to expect. It was going to be thoroughly inspired. The patriarch was going to tell me directly what he got from God. And it sounds like from what Matt says here, that the church leaders themselves have tacitly admitted that these are uninspired fortune tellers. And
Brother Bowen, behave yourself.
I was happy to know and very proud that I was of the favored tribe of Ephraim. I didn't know what I'd done to deserve that, but I figured it must have been something. 30 years later, I sat in on one of my children's patriarchal blessings, and found out that my child is of the tribe of Manasseh. And I'm just wondering, is there any way to find out if he's legitimate?
I'm going to borrow Sterling's answer. I don't know.
I will comment that Brigham Young would say that You would have a family, and seven of them might be outside of the tribe of Israel, but the eighth would be pure blood of Ephraim. So you're looking for kind of a systematic, rational answer to how lineage is passed, because you have a sense of Mendelian genetics and how genes are passed that is foreign to the way people were thinking when this was first established.
Awesome presentations. They were fantastic. So I have a question with regards to pushback in the 20th century. You know, a lot of times today we will cite the second article of faith: men are punished for their own sins and not for Adam's or Ham's or Cain's transgression. I'm just wondering, as well as Nephi, all are alike unto God, bond and free. I'm just wondering, in the 20th century, was there any pushback at all on this idea of curse of Cain, curse of Ham sort of thing?
Pushback from
you mean? From church members or other apostles. It sounds like I didn't hear any pushback. It was just like, well, it's the pre-existence or the curse of Ham, and that there was never any pushback on, hey, I don't think that's theological, and it seems to disagree with the second article of faith specifically.
So a couple thoughts. There's lots of pushback. There's a huge underground current of Latter-day Saints who do not accept this doctrine, and I'll just throw out a teaser. I talk about this in my next book. The teaser would be that probably half, and Bruce Van Orden, I'm looking at you, your former colleagues in BYU religion, I'm just guesstimating, but half the BYU religion faculty in the 50s and 60s did not support the priesthood ban. There is a huge undercurrent of letters being sent back and forth, and they're writing Lowry Nelson. Some of you may know that he used to teach at BYU. He was Ezra Taft Benson's professor. He left under somewhat controversial circumstances. But anyway, Lowry Nelson writes the First Presidency in 1948-49, and which becomes the genesis of the First Presidency document, establishing the ban as doctrine, as Newell will describe later on today. And anyway, they in the First Presidency, writes Lowry Nelson back, and BYU professors, they're just exchanging all of this stuff, and they write Lowry Nelson, oh, thank you. You have the courage and the liberality to say what we want to say, but we can't because of the constraints of our employment. There is a lot of this stuff going on, and sad to say that, Rick Bennett, sad to say that some people get excommunicated for their outspoken views. It's a sad story.
And beyond that, there was Hubie Brown, who famously was actively working to oppose it. And beyond that, in 1900, you can look at the First Presidency Minutes meetings to see that Lorenzo Snow wanted to call a meeting of the 12 to reevaluate the application of the ban. And George Q. Cannon essentially says, who are you to question this? And the answer was, Lorenzo Snow was the prophet of God.
I'm sorry I missed the first half of Sterling's. I was prevented from getting to the door by some unidentified Danites that blocked my path. But I finally got in, and I grew up in Michigan, and I was a fan of Governor George Romney. I'm not a fan of his son, but I was a fan of George. And he was terrific on civil rights. During the riots, he marched in for civil rights demonstrations. He walked the streets of Detroit, inner city, during the riots and so forth. But anyway, my understanding from people in the church, from the LDS church who knew him then, was that he did things like he got up and spoke at state conference. At the end of the conference, it came right after King's assassination, and nothing had been said about King. He got up and made a nice tribute to King and so forth. So I do have a copy of a 3-page letter that Apostle Delbert Stapley sent to George Romney. Any of you have seen that?
I've gone through the Romney papers.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah.
Somehow I got a copy of it, and it's just horrendous. He says that maybe the craziest thing of all, he says that the reason Abraham Lincoln and John Kennedy were assassinated was they didn't follow the racial teachings of Joseph Smith, and they adopted the ultra-conservative racist line of the church. And I think Romney just stuck the letter in his file. I'm not sure about that. But anyway, I just wonder if you guys have any more information that would be useful at this time, even though I know it's off topic, about George Romney and his views on race. Because so far, what I know about him is pretty much good, but maybe my heroes had flaws I'm not aware of on that issue.
So just to, I'll be brief. So George Romney, Bill, George Romney is, two thoughts I want to share. George Romney and Stuart Udall both have grave concerns about the priesthood ban in the 1960s. These are two high-profile government officials. They're in the news a lot. One is active and loyal to the church, George Romney. One has sort of faded away over time, Stuart Udall. And they share correspondence in the 1960s about the paths not taken. And Stuart Udall tries to get George Romney to team up in that dialogue article in 1967 that gets him in a lot of hot water. And Romney politely declines. That's the first point I'll make. The second point I'll make is that when he's running for national political office, both in Michigan and then later on as a national political candidate, George Romney will do what his son, Mitt Romney, will do some four decades later, which is to say that when journalists and reporters asked about his church's racism and priesthood ban and all of that, they would avoid the hot seat running for political office.
Would you rather I ask a question about Lamanites after, since you've not talked about them?
Go ahead.
Okay, I just returned from Guatemala with the Liahona Foundation out here in the hallway, and I spent 9 days. My translator and my guide were Guatemalans, and one night in the hotel I said, you guys are Mormons, you're Lamanites, right? Recount for me now. How come your skin is dark and you have brown eyes and beautiful brown skin and I'm just kind of a pasty old blonde? And they laughed. And I said, from the Book of Mormon, tell me. So they recounted the curse on Laman and Lemuel. And I said, now, in the Book of Mormon, about 50 years after they arrived in the New World, they had these battles between the Nephites and the Lamanites. And they talked about huge numbers of people fighting those battles and huge numbers of dead. How do you think the Nephites got enough people to fight those battles if they didn't bring in the pre-existing natives and marry them? Well, I don't know. Well, if they did bring them in and intermarried with them, the Nephites would be look like you, not like me. So how do we in the church deal with the brown skin curse on the Lamanites? I haven't heard that any changes have been made. It's illogical. Nephites had to have the same, by virtue of the phenotypic ratio, if I marry her, our kids are going to look like her 3 times out of 4, not like me.
It's Sterling's turn to answer the question.
I appreciate that because I am well qualified to answer it. I don't know.
But let me say, I don't know the answer to the question, but just the broader context would be that the church today has a huge problem with the racialist verses in the Book of Mormon. There's no doubt about it. When we talk about racism in the church, this is the elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about. And they become racialized, whatever the intention of the authors meant, it's become racialized in both the 19th and the 20th centuries. It's easy to read Lamanites into the curses and the lifting of the curses. But what's less clear is that in the 20th century, Joseph Fielding Smith, and not all, but some other apostles, have racialized these verses to include African Americans. And in private, they're not saying this in public. The Lamanite stuff is in public quite a bit. In private, they're talking about how black people, when they join the church, either in mortality or in the resurrection, some of the 12 are divided on this, skin will become lighter and the curse will be lifted. And black Latter-day Saints, there's a pretty good record of this, black Latter-day Saints will read these Book of Mormon verses and they'll wonder, quote, as Darius Gray once said, how does it apply to me, end quote. And that was an oral history Darius gave in 1971. So black folks are, black saints are certainly affected by this. And the last thing is that we still see this kind of nonsense today, and we've got to call it for what it is. There are BYU students, there are other folks in the church who will look at people of color and they'll say, you know what, I'm not going to recognize you in the resurrection. And their brown or black-skinned roommate will say, what are you talking about? Because your curse will be lifted. That is so patently offensive and degrading. And that stuff is still out there more than we'd like to think.
So I want to ask about blood,
skin and lineage. Most, you've largely talked in terms of lineage, Sterling. You talked a little bit about blood, but are those concepts interchangeable? Are they different? And then I want to share two anecdotes. So my grandmother's patriarchal blessing says she's of the tribe of Judah, and nobody else in the family ends up tribe of Judah. Her grandfather was one of the first Jewish people to join the church, so she was a Rosenbaum. But almost nobody else gets tribe of Judah. And then my father, when he joined the church in Pontiac, Michigan in the 1950s, understood that he was adopted into the house of Israel, but he also understood that his blood was literally changed. And so that pre and post baptism, he has different blood.
Forget about 3 minutes. Just...
Well, you can talk to her on the driveway home. Go ahead.
Yeah, that whole concept of blood being changed, that was a concept that goes back to the 19th century, and it pops up every once in a while, you know, later on. But it was Brigham Young and other church writers that talked about the impure blood literally being purged out, and Sterling mentions that in, you know, some of the tracts and that were written and distributed by the. By the genealogical society. So that's one of those myths or misperceptions, whatever you want to call it, that has persisted right down to the present.
And I'll just add, we'll take your question. I'll just add that the bleeding blood comment is first made by Joseph Smith, I think in the 1830s. And I just would suggest we have to remember that in the 1830s, what was known about what blood is, transmitted about yourself, your essence, the way people thought about it was hugely different now. And so we kind of get stuck, and you see this in Bruce R. McConkie's 1958 Mormon Doctrine. He repeats it long after we should have been able to reevaluate, because now we know more about what blood is and how traits are passed through DNA, but we didn't.
Okay, so I wanted to comment on that British Israelism. So those are concepts of the whole Israel tribes going into Europe. So those are concepts I grew up with. I was born in 1980, and our family was huge into that. And I've noticed, I've noticed that our family was not unique on that. Like, even on my in-laws, I've found that there's older people, and typically they're big into family history. They're huge genealogists, and they also happen to be, so this now starts to make sense. But what is disturbing to me is that these same ideas that were popularized so much by the church are now being used politically, especially like with the whole white culture and alt-right movement. So is there any way, is it even feasible for the church to somehow be able to discourage these things without, you know, completely to repudiate these ideas? Is it even possible for them to do it given the history of pushing these ideas?
Hi, Sterling, you want to take that one?
Well, first, to your point about a connection politically and theologically, yes, that happens now, and it was happening in the 1920s and 30s and in the 1870s and in the 1840s. You could look at America's history where we had essentially a triumphalism of our system. There was English triumphalism, too. And British Israelism was a kind of a Christian Protestant manifestation of the political colonialism. So there has been a long tie, and that happens today. Could we repudiate it? Yes, again, I think we could in an instant say, oops, we're wrong on that chosen lineage business, and let's get back to church and preach Christ and Him converted, and that would be the end of it.